then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's September the 12th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Hi, guys. This is going to be a fairly heavy episode of Radio Free Northwest, consisting first of Andy Donner raving at you for a while, and then the rest of it will be mostly me. So, here goes.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. It's time for me to get down to brass tacks and actually talk about white character step one. First, here's a brief recap and a bit of an admonition. If we fix the white race's character problem, or more precisely, if enough white people fix their own character problems, we fix white genocide, and that's why this matters. I've told you that I have criteria for how I make decisions, and sometimes pronouncements, as required by my duty station in the party. As it turns out, there's a parallel between the steps required to secure our race's new nation, the Northwest American Republic, and securing an individual's white character. I can't go into real detail about the festivities depicted in the Northwest independence novels for two reasons. First, we don't actually know them, since this process is always a play-it-by-ear shindig. Second, it's not a good idea to discuss such things anyway, since it would result in more fantasy instead of actual racial effort. Providentially, I can't go into details about each individual's character problem, since I don't know each individual. Having done these things myself, I am qualified enough to give some sort of blueprint, even if such a thing really doesn't exist. Please realize I can't give you a detailed step-by-step plan, even if that's what I have to try to do. I found the party, learned about the Butler Plan and the Northwest Imperative, and thought about these things for a long time. I decided what I had to do and did it. Because of this, I can give you milestones to shoot for, just like there are going to be milestones a revolution must achieve to gauge its own success. Just like each revolution is unique to itself, each white character story is unique to itself. The only person who can tell the story is the person who did the work. With this understanding, there are two main points I must finish my disclaimer with. First, you have to do this. White character correction isn't a passive project, since it requires a hefty amount of self-critique and self-control. Just like anything else, you get out of it what you put into it. To pull off my character correction in Northwest Migration, I had to put quite a bit of effort into the self-control, self-discipline, and self-improvement required to become the person I needed to be. The party regularly receives an impassioned inquiry asking how someone could fix their character. Many are in the form of emails which Mr. Covington read on Radio Free Northwest before I found the party. Olivia has covered more than one of them as well. I know some of you really do want to hear this. If you're among that group, please comprehend that it's going to take some work. The second point of the disclaimer is more or less a summary of everything I've ever said on Radio Free Northwest, including White Character Step Zero. Somehow, I wasn't clear enough about Step Zero. Religion wasn't the point at all. The point was to stop doing things you're not supposed to be doing. I call these things anti-organization activities. They're things which seem like worthwhile projects yet actually keep participants distracted from what they really need to do. Waking people up, obsession with disasters and collapses, and concentration on government conspiracy theories, as valid as they are almost as bad as freaking out over various religious issues. Just today on Facebook, someone flat-out refused to participate in the Northwest Imperative because they are waiting for the end times to wrap things up. Really, people do actually flip out over these things that aren't real or don't matter because they get a contact high. The white nationalist movement is more addictive than any drug, and we all need our fix. The problem is that the low-quality substitutes for real activity are a whole lot easier to obtain than the real thing. My point is this. The white character repair process is not fun. If the white person in question is being honest, after completing step one, which I'll get to in a second, they're going to have to face down all the bad things about themselves and their life. Further, they're going to have to part with nearly all of them, and this is where the real effort comes in. Each of us has baggage, habits, and other things we have to let go of because they're not good for us. The upswing to this is that the real task of white character repair and Northwest migration is making white people who they really need to be. Successfully completing your character project results in a proper homecoming, and this process, as I've said before, equips you for the larger task at hand. Like I keep saying, this character work is a microcosm, or smaller-scale version of, the process of creating the Northwest American Republic. If at any point you need some real motivation, step one, which is what I'm getting into today, is the way you're going to keep your spirit up. Fixing your character will make you the sort of person your ancestors would approve of, which is the sort of person the party needs to help jumpstart the revolution. Here's a bird's-eye view of the revolutionary process. Decide what you want and why you want it. Understand the difference between where you want to be, or what you want to have, and where you are right now, or what you have at the moment. This is the same as figuring out what is needed to achieve your goal you decided on. Do the legwork to get ready to implement that goal. This means preparing yourself and establishing a strategy for whatever effort is required. The last step is to execute the effort. There's really another implicit step, which is follow-up once the initial goal is reached, but that's not of immediate concern. If this doesn't sound like the profundity you were expecting, that's because it isn't. When you break it down, you see that this is how every task is accomplished. If you were expecting anything more cryptic or complicated than what I've just said, you're trying too hard. And yeah, trying too hard is a thing, which you just did. But that's actually somewhat justifiable in this case. Let me explain. I'm willing to accept that applying this process to white character is hard, because applying it to a large task, like revolutionary activity, is that much harder. If revolution is hard, and white character is a microcosm of Northwest revolution, then it's only reasonable of me to acknowledge the scale of the white character task is far larger than something like planning a trip to the grocery store or a day trip out of town. This means, among other things, I've got to be very, very careful how I describe the first two steps. If they're implemented correctly, there's a good chance each interested person will be off and running all on their own. There's an added difficulty to my task here, since the first two steps are the two humps individuals have to get over. They're the hardest, in my opinion, because they involve understanding, thought, and mental discipline. They hurt the most, even more than loading the moving van. They require you to admit your faults to yourself. So, step one. Decide what you want and why you want it. The revolution-scale version of this step is declaring the goal of the Northwest American Republic. The individual-scale version is Northwest migration. Your homecoming. At least, those are the right answers. And what's more important to observe about this point is that the goal of homecoming follows the goal of the Northwest American Republic. If you honestly want the Republic, it will naturally follow that you want your own migration. If you're going to accomplish this for yourself, you really do need to figure out why you're a white nationalist and what you intend to do about it. This, more than anything else, is the first hump we don't seem to get over on an individual basis. It's what the party needs from all of you, and it's pretty clearly the one thing people won't do. Remember that song with the lyrics, "I'll do anything for love, but I won't do that"? Well, you might say the white nationalist motto is, "I'll do anything for my race, but I won't do that," where that is the Butler Plan. So what gives? The idea of Northwest migration drives people insane like nothing else in the movement. Hours before coming up with this material, I got into it with an up-and-coming white nationalist movement figure on Facebook. I didn't even look for an argument either. We were having a casual conversation in the open and exchanging ideas and concerns. The same discussion was roughly parallel to another I had earlier in the morning, only much less civil. The morning discussion was, once again, centered around religious obsession. This one guy, who happened to be some variant of Christian identity, had the goal of waiting for the end of the world to fulfill his racial purpose. Since that sort of thing has been tried over and over again, I have to call people on it when I see it. He's a good example of what happens when a person chooses a goal for their own sake instead of the race's sake. If no resistance is possible, then choose a goal that lets you off the hook, right? The Jews really are all-powerful, aren't they? Surely we can't stand up to Zog. Except we can. Barefoot brown monkeys all over the Middle East are putting Zog to shame and have been for a very long time now. Resistance is entirely possible. Getting back to my interaction with this up-and-comer in the movement, everything was fine until he randomly flipped out at me. It took me a while to figure out what the problem was. It ended up being that I asked an open-ended question about what our goals ought to be, and specifically whether or not we should support America. That sounds bad, but I was merely responding to a remark he made, which, to be fair, was very correct. He started off by saying white people needed to be willing to give things up for the race and participate in racial political work for the good of all white people. They can't be selfish, and they should be involved, even at great cost to themselves. Okay, I'm on board with all of that. So we started talking, and it went fine for quite some time. We were just shooting the breeze, and I asked what he thought the underlying issue was in response to his pro-America commentary. I brought up the phenomenon of white people, especially all over the internet, pledging that they're ready to do whatever is required, even to give their lives in dramatic fashion, for the good of their race. I asked him if he gets the same response we do when we give people a workable strategy. For those of you coming in late, the response we at the Northwest Front get most often is usually someone dropping off the grid or walking back their declarations of heroic racial intent. I told this guy I was worried about the same things he was talking about, and I asked his thoughts on why people act this way. After all, he was making some very salient Facebook status updates on why people aren't willing to give up their own personal desires. I wanted to know what else he thought. He snapped as soon as I echoed his concerns, but from a Northwest Front perspective. Apparently, we're just running our mouths up here, and if we really wanted change, we could make it happen, and all the other stuff he already said. As it happens, this type of white nationalist chimp-out occurs all the time as it relates to the Northwest. For some reason, the requirement of Northwest migration seems to drive people who talk this way up the wall. He just got done telling the entire movement how they were wrong for various types of selfishness and thereby shirking their racial responsibilities. For just a brief moment, I had to make sure I wasn't reading one of my own RFN scripts, or perhaps a bit of written commentary from Mr. Covington and other RFN contributors. But the difference is this. I brought up the only possible plan to save the white race, and all of a sudden, he couldn't be bothered. In no permutation of reality does this make any political sense, and everyone knows it. Here's where this becomes applicable to those trying to fix up their own character. This movement leader's goal was to bring back America and get people active and all that good stuff, but that's not really a goal. Even if it were an actual objective, taking America back for white people isn't possible anymore. This idea of actually securing the existence of our people and a future for white children would get in the way of his American dream fantasy. How awful of me to suggest he give up his own personal desire and expend effort to help the race. Instead, I'm just running my mouth, and I should be willing to make change happen and all that stuff. Never mind that he won't adopt a workable plan and set a proper goal, and never mind that I actually made the changes and sacrifices required to help with the only plan we have to save our race from its ongoing genocide. Nope, it doesn't matter. He can blow smoke while pretending to have moral high ground, and I can eat his dust while actually trying to save our race. Ignore the obvious hypocrisy in this example, because it's not the point. The actual point is just what I said. The single effective and possible plan to implement the 14 words isn't for him since it contradicts his existing goal. That's a big problem. When you guys don't choose a goal or choose the wrong one, you're dooming your effort from the start. This is why I gave that talk on anti-organizational activities months ago. Getting stuck in a rut like waking people up, pretending resistance isn't possible, conspiracy theory, and all sorts of other things tells us you're not making real political calculations and basing your goals on logical derivations from the real world. Every white nationalist outfit I've encountered, with the exception of the Northwest Front, wants to get everyone they come into contact with fired up to go out and get more people fired up. But for what? I've always asked this question, and politely at that. I've always wanted to know what other white nationalists think the objective should be for the whole movement. I never get an answer. In quite a few cases, I get abuse instead, despite my being very interested in what they're saying and genuinely trying to understand what they want. It turns out they don't want anything. In the cases where they are at least trying some sort of organizational activity, they just want more organizational activity. There's never a tangible result they seek to produce. In a very few cases, I might hear something as specific as taking America back. But that's not even possible anymore. These people, like every other nationalist the party hears from, want each and every white person to drop what they're doing and, well, I'm not sure what. Oh, and everyone needs to be willing to sacrifice for it. Everyone but them. When I suggest they live by their own standard and come home to help the party, I'm always accused of being a fake of some sort, even though I did the work first and did the talking later. So, what's it going to be? What do you want out of all of this? Why are you here? You're going to have to decide. Mr. Covington has asked this before, but it really would be decent of you to at least consider your answer this time. After all, if you're listening to Radio Free Northwest, it's because you know there's no hope for taking back all of America for the white man, and you're seriously considering alternative politics. Revolutionary politics. Further, you all know that your part of the country is either a power center or else it's already overrun. If we're going to get our own slice of the pie, it has to be in the Pacific Northwest. None of this is new information for the long-time listeners here. Exactly what's holding you up? Most of the people listening to me right now have made all sorts of public vows that they will do anything they need to for their race. So why don't you? Why don't you dedicate yourself to the Northwest imperative and allow yourself to come to the conclusion that you need to come home and help the Northwest Front execute the Butler Plan? Now, remember, I'm delivering milestones and not specific steps. Whatever it is that's keeping you from making the right choice to begin your migration process, you're going to have to deal with it on your own. Even if I knew what it were in each of your cases, I wouldn't be able to do anything about it for you. I know the party is really getting on people's nerves with this. Lately, I've been confronted by quite a few nationalists, some of whom live in the homeland, about the party's anti-American stance. America is the problem, and even if it weren't, it's long past being salvageable. It's easier to pretend otherwise than admit you're going to have to give up the fantasy and come home to help the party. White enclaves, activist networking, waking people up, such as it is, getting people involved, and all the other things everyone insists need to happen, have no point if they're not going somewhere. Any sane person can tell we're headed into a mess in which all of these things, noble as they might be, don't affect at all. We're going to have to confront the people doing us harm and make Zog leave us alone in our own country. There isn't another favorable, possible, legal, peaceful, or pleasant way forward. In the long run, it's the Northwest or death, and you all know it. I know I'm starting to rant, so I'll wrap this up. It's not mature, responsible, reasonable, or even respectable to pretend there's any other workable alternative to the Northwest Imperative and the Butler Plan. Remember that talk I gave on solutions versus non-solutions? Or better yet, anti-solutions? Activity for the sake of activity doesn't amount to anything, and involvement for the sake of involvement only wastes time and resources. Further, there seems to be a trend of people outing themselves because they want to be white racial activists. That's going to cost them. Yeah, there's some risk involved in everything, but why blow your own cover on something that has zero chance of producing a real result? If you're serious as you say you are, you'd take stock of the available options and dedicate yourself to the Northwest American Republic. And in doing so, you'd settle on migration as the only way forward for serious white nationalists. That's step one for you. Hail victory, comrades.
As I've already mentioned in the past few episodes, my dreaded 60th birthday is on Saturday. So here is a special song that a supporter sent to me and asked me to play on the show in honor of the event. Now, what exactly this has to do with me turning 60, I have no idea, but what the hell. This is No Remorse.
I live my life of ideology. I pride myself on racial loyalty. Without these things, I'd have no identity. I reject multi-racial obscurity. White national socialist, proud to be, and you could be a white national socialist. With honor and loyalty. White national socialist, proud to be, and you could be a white national socialist. With honor and loyalty. I separate myself from this society. I don't need their filth or their sociology. Free. I make my claim, this is my country. White national socialist, proud to be, and you could be a white national socialist with honor and loyalty. White national socialist, proud to be. You could be a white national socialist with honor and loyalty.
Right. There are a number of serious things I need to talk to you guys about now, and they're probably going to take up the rest of the podcast with a few music breaks, of course. Now, first off, I need to tell you, all of you listening to this, very clearly, something that is going to cause a lot of sound and fury and gnashing of teeth and rending of garments and howling at the moon like lost souls among the goat dancing crowd and some of you as well. Now, what I need to tell you is something I never thought I would have to say, in that in certain circumstances, I will rat you out to the police. Not the FBI, I would never stoop that low. But if anyone does certain things from now on, I'm going to be compelled to call the local cops on him, and what they do with it is up to them, just so long as I get a written report on record showing that I made the call. Now, let me explain what the hell I'm talking about here, and you all need to listen to this because it's very important and could possibly even save your life. Now, you yourself might be targeted by the dictatorship for victimization in this very manner. I am not blowing smoke here. I'm not exaggerating. I'm not just talking to hear my head roar. This is for real. I have picked up some of this information off the internet, which I know is not the best source in the world. But then again, there's also a lot of truth out there, and I've been having some private conversations with people who are in a position to know about certain things. And yes, I mean they really know. This is the goods. So I repeat, all of you, listen to this. For some time now, the Federal Bureau of Investigation has been fabricating so-called terrorism cases against individuals, mostly young Arabs and Muslims, but also against a few of us. Now, we know this. I'm not just talking about Edgar Steele and Bill White. I'm talking about almost all of the terrorism cases which have occurred since 9/11. I keep on saying this, people, but you really, really need to wrap your arms around it. Remember, without terrorists, there can't be anti-terrorists. Anti-terrorism is a multi-billion dollar industry in this country. And if there were suddenly no more terrorists, then all those billions of tax dollars would find their way into other government departments and not into the hands of our friends in the silk suits. The way you build an empire in government service is to make sure that your department or your section, whatever, gets the biggest possible share of all those lovely taxpayer dollars. Problem is that there are not very many genuine terrorist attacks out there. Matter of fact, since 9/11, there haven't really been any except one or two, like that doctor going berserk in Fort Hood, and that was basically just one guy who snapped and couldn't take being part of an army that was slaughtering his own people anymore. I think the jury is still out on these Tsarnaev brothers in Boston. There seem to be some funny things about them that no one quite can figure out. But anyway, the fact is, and again I say, burn this into your brain because it explains so much. Without terrorists, there can be no anti-terrorists. And if there are no real terrorists out there to get the FBI and ATF and all the various assorted offices and departments all that lovely taxpayer money, then the FBI and the ATF and the DHS, etc., etc., have to make them up. This is what has been happening now for almost 12 years in this country. Other activities along this line have consisted not just of the usual commoner garden variety entrapment, but sometimes the FBI will pick some poor old Apu from the local quickie mart or some confused Muslim teenager in New Jersey or Michigan, and they surround him with a whole squad of undercover agents and informants and set him up with a dud truck bomb or a suicide vest and something that can't possibly explode, and they egg him on to go out and try and blow something up until finally he gives in. And all of a sudden, he's looking at all his former friends through the bars and headed for a 50-year sentence for walking downtown wearing a few blocks of Play-Doh. That is the overt act in furtherance of conspiracy which the law requires. Basically, the Federal Bureau of Investigation sets up the conspiracy, including supplying fake explosive, and this one kid, or one poor old Muslim schmuck, carries out the overt act, and the one guy, of course, is the only one who goes to prison. God knows how many millions of dollars these things cost. But they keep up the appearance that there is some kind of terrorism going on in this country. Unfortunately, no, there's not. Now, the FBI admits in court that they have entrapped these poor dumb bastards from the get-go, and that there never would have been any so-called terrorism without their active participation and instigation. Now, that used to be the classic definition of entrapment, but no more. The judges are simply rewriting the law and rewriting the rules of legal procedure. The depraved judges and the courts have upheld this procedure of deliberate malice aforethought entrapment as legal. And there are some Muslim men and Muslim kids sitting in prison doing 50-year sentences right now because they were completely set up from square one by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So we know that the FBI is morally capable of simply lying people into prison in order to get their numbers up. There seems to be a lot of that going on in the Spokane office because they got a bunch of FBI and ATF agents out there who have nice houses and white neighborhoods and kids going to nice white schools and they don't want to have to move to Detroit or Los Angeles or Newark or some other American shithole full of real Muslims and niggers, some of whom might be real terrorists and who might try to hurt them. Now, what I'm on about here is that there is a new twist on this little FBI scam that they're now trying out. Acting through its own agents and informants, and also through surrogates and what are known as NGOs, non-governmental organizations, such as the Anti-Defamation League B'nai B'rith and the Southern Poverty Law Center, the FBI and presumably other alphabet soup agencies are now engaging in a kind of pilot program of deliberate entrapment through the use of what's called proffers or criminal solicitations, which place the targeted individual in an impossible legal position unless he rats on whoever is making the so-called proffer, and of course by doing so thereby marks himself forever as an informant. In other words, it's not enough anymore just to tell the government operative on the other end of the computer or sitting in your living room, as the case may be, just to fuck off and get the hell out of here. You are required by law to pick up the phone and call the police. or else you yourself will be charged with criminal conspiracy or obstruction of justice for failure to report an alleged terrorist threat or criminal conspiracy, which will be the object of the game. The really nasty part is that no charges at all will be brought against the informant who made the criminal solicitation if his FBI handlers back him up in court that he did so at their instigation. I think this is one reason why they're probably going to start using badge-carrying undercover agents like the notorious Bernard Butkovich for this. An actual badge will give an informant like that more credibility. I repeat, recent court rulings have eviscerated entrapment law and made this kind of thing completely legal. Well, basically, in this country, anything is legal that a judge will put up with. Now, this means that someone can offer to commit a crime for you. You can tell them to piss off, but if you don't call the law and immediately set off 20 years of goat dancing on the internet about how you're an informant and a rat, mostly by the same kind of government cognitive dissonance ops, by the way, if you don't do that, you will be the one who goes to jail for failing to report to the FBI that one of their own people solicited a crime or approval of a crime from you. Yeah, I know this country is becoming a kind of Mad Hatter's Tea Party. Of course, it always was. Tony Evola, the FBI backed up, and Matt Hale went away for 40 years for typing a single sentence in an AOL chat room, that sentence being, "I cannot be involved in this." Hal Turner's FBI handlers did not back him up and disavowed him, either because Turner really went rogue or else because they just simply didn't like him, which I can believe. And so Turner himself went to prison for soliciting violence against federal judges. That's another little interesting commentary for all you guys out there who might be considering going to work for the Bureau. You can't trust your FBI handlers to back you up when the heat comes on. They hung Hal Turner out to dry when it turns out that their careers were on the line. You can never, ever trust a federal law enforcement agent to keep his word. He is convinced that he is better than you, that you are pond scum, and he is not under any moral obligation to fulfill any promise he makes to you. Anyone who expects the FBI or any kind of federal cop or U.S. attorney to keep their word is an idiot. So, let me make something clear. There is no way around this, and since one of my goals in life is to make these dogs prefer the real charges against me when they finally take me away, i.e. I want them to charge me with something I have written or said that is political and racial in nature, not some stupid horseshit that they just made up pretending that I've committed a crime. If anything like this happens, I will have no choice but to play this bird-brained game by their rules. I am giving all of you fair warning that if anyone sends me any emails containing any kind of solicitation to commit a crime or asking my blessing to commit a crime, by which I mean a serious felony, I'm not talking about conspiracy to distribute leaflets and business cards and that sort of thing, which are protected by the First Amendment. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about. If you do it, I'm going to call the cops on you. Not the FBI. I'll try never to sink that low, but it will at least be the local county Mounties or the Washington State Police so I can get a written report on file showing that at such and such a time, on such and such a date, I did make the call and do my civic duty, blah, 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 blah. Now, whether this will stop the FBI from attempting this tactic on me, I don't know. So far, no one has been smart enough or unethical enough to leap to his cell phone and dial 911 after he gets one of these funny emails from somebody he barely knows, so we really don't know how effective just plain reporting it immediately will in fact be when the FBI starts kicking in your door, and then all of a sudden they're confronted with some kind of report from the local state police or whatever that, yes, you did pick up the phone and you did call. That might work, it might not, we don't know. Now, the second thing that certain unknown parties are doing recently, presumably the Federal Bureau of Investigation and other government agencies, again acting through surrogates, is emailing political activists on both the left and the right who are critical of the dictatorship child pornography in the form of email attachments. Now, I didn't know this myself until recently, but if you actually open any of that filth and view any of the images, even if you do so for 5 seconds and completely inadvertently and without any prior knowledge at all, unless you immediately, as in within 30 seconds or so, call the police or the FBI, you are guilty of possessing it. In a kiddie porn case, the onus is on you to prove your innocence. If it is on your computer, you are guilty, 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 and it is damn near impossible to prove that it was sent to you without your knowledge. If you wait too long, they will claim that you were sitting there ogling the images or whatever. Now, if you attempt to delete the kiddie porn from your computer, then you're guilty of trying to destroy or suppress evidence in a federal felony. And please remember that that key on your computer that says delete, it doesn't. There is no such thing as gone on the internet or on a hard drive. Even when you format a hard drive, there are programs that can pick up little bits and pieces of your data. So again, if this ever happens to you, bear in mind it's not enough to just curse in horror and loathing and delete the goddamn thing from your computer. If the FBI kicks in your door, they can find it on your computer even if you have deleted it. And if you do not immediately call the law when that happens, you are in violation of the law, and they will use it against you. Kiddie porn is one of those charges where nobody wants to hear any kind of defense. It's like an accusation of witchcraft in the Middle Ages. There is no defense. I'm frankly surprised that they haven't used it any more than they have. And yes, I am familiar with Kevin Alfred Strom's claim that he was framed. He was not. He confessed. I heard him. He's guilty in his case, and he is a pedophile and a registered sex offender, and he should be. So the Kevin Alfred Strom case was not a case of the FBI or anybody framing him. Let's get that clear. That doesn't mean that they won't do it. Well, like I said, I turned 60 on Saturday, and one of the, in many respects, best parts of my life has been that I have been destined or doomed to see the last phases of the old world. I've seen the last of the white world before it died. I grew up in the last of the Old South. I'm still old enough to remember a few coloreds-only signs on restrooms. Don't remember any water fountains. But I do remember that. I remember beginning my education in a segregated school system, which was wonderful, going out on a little playground with nothing but white kids. You never really know what you've got till it's gone, do you? In the 1970s, I saw the last of the old British Empire in Rhodesia. In 1974, I lived and worked in South Africa under apartheid in Johannesburg for a construction company. And so I saw the last of the old world of South Africa. And in the 1980s, courtesy of the U.S. Attorney in Greensboro, North Carolina, and the FBI and the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Unit of the federal government, who hand-delivered my passport to me in Charleston with a suggestion that I use it, I ended up in Ireland, and I spent almost 5 years in Ireland and the Isle of Man with a few trips to London in between, and I saw the last of the old Ireland, especially the last of the old Dublin before it became a colony of Nigeria. I'm not going to get into a long nostalgic reminiscence about that, but like all those old, completely white places in our past, which I think are kind of imprinted on our genetic memory in most of us, it was a wonderful experience. It was a wonderful time and place. Despite all my many problems I had at the time, I will always have memories of the old Dublin, some of which are really wonderful. And I always figured that if the FBI kicks in my door tomorrow and drags me away, there's just certain things that they can't take from me. They can't take my sort of Tom Sawyer-ish upbringing in North Carolina. Yeah, I know it wasn't all Tom Sawyer. I know there was bad parts, but I think like everybody else, you kind of tend to remember the good and not the bad. They can't take Rhodesia from me. They can't take Johannesburg. And above all, they can't take the old Dublin that I remember from the early 1980s, the last of the old Ireland. This is a song by Ireland's greatest living tenor, in my opinion, Paddy Reilly. And it's one that brings that time back to me in my mind. The song's called Raglan Road, and I know because I used to go up and down Raglan Road fairly often back in the day. Anyway, this is Paddy Reilly.
On Raglan Road of an autumn day, I saw her first and knew that her dark hair would weave a snare that I might one day rue. I saw the danger and I passed along the enchanted
wonted way. And I said, let grief be a fallen leaf at the dawning of the day. On Grafton Street in November, we tripped lightly along the ledge of a deep ravine where can be seen the work of passion's pledge. The queen of hearts still making tarts, and I not making hay. Oh, I loved too much, and by such is happiness thrown away. I gave her gifts of the mind, I gave her the secret sign that's known to the artists who have known that through God of sound and stone and word and tint, I did not stint. For I gave her poems to say with her own name there and her own dark hair like clouds over fields of May. On a quiet street where old ghosts meet, I see her walking out. Away from me, so hurriedly, my reason must allow that I had loved not as I should, a creature made of clay. When the angel wooed, the clay he blows his wings at the dawn of day.
I'm now going to address something that I haven't actually sat down and talked about in some years now, because I'm always a bit bemused that it's necessary for me to talk to you about it at all. But I guess it's become necessary again. First, a couple of by-the-by comments. Many years ago, I heard an interview with the famous wrestler Ric Flair, who was with the WWF at the time. That's one of the older professional wrestling groups. Now, everybody knows that professional wrestling is fake, of course. But you still have to be quite the athlete to pull it off and sling a 220-pound opponent around on the ropes and a canvas. And someone was asking Flair if he ever worried that he might get hurt in the ring. Flair replied, "Oh, no, not at all. These guys are all trained professionals. We like each other. We know all the moves, and accidents are almost unheard of. But I'll tell you what does scare the shit out of me. It's these damned crazy fans who can't tell the difference between what's real and what's fantasy, and they think it's all real." Okay, second introductory comment. Now, one of the most pathetic things I have ever read has to do with the Scottish author J.K. Rowling, the woman who wrote the Harry Potter books. And that is that when her novel series first became popular and started taking off, she would get hundreds and thousands of letters from little school children all across Britain asking her how to find Platform 9 3/4 at Paddington Station or wherever it was, and how they could go to school at Hogwarts and become wizards and witches. They thought that her books were real. There is a similarity between this attitude and an email I got this week. I'm not going to read the email itself, even though my NSA and FBI monitors have probably picked up on it, because it came in as a comment on one of the blogs, nor will I name the person who sent this email, lest I get him jammed up in some way, but I will paraphrase what he said to me. Now, the gist of this man's comment was that I am responsible for the failure of the Northwest Front because I am a money-grubbing fraud who has not delivered what he promised, which is, apparently, a violent IRA-style guerrilla campaign in the Pacific Northwest, exactly like in my novels, and that white people are deeply disappointed in me because I haven't started killing niggers and blowing up bridges and whatnot yet. Now, that's what this guy got from my books. That I was promising to lead some kind of armed insurrection against the United States, right here, right now, without any political preparation on the ground, while all of the muscle men in the suits and the black body armor are still getting their paychecks and still ready to kill for the people who pay them. Apparently, I was just going to leap up and whip out my 70-year-old museum piece of a handgun and start blasting away like it was the sands of Iwo Jima. And no, this isn't the first time. There are apparently others who somehow got that from my books. I've often mentioned in the past that some of you seem to have this idea that one day you're going to turn on your television sets as you sit on your sofa and take the nice salty snacks into your mouth and swill that beer, and you're going to see me mounted on a white horse, flourishing my saber aloft with my cape flapping in the wind and yelling, "Charge!" like Teddy in Arsenic and Old Lace. Or else I'll be standing on a picnic table in a public park somewhere again with the cape and inciting a mob with pitchforks and torches to storm the Bastille, or at least the local television station. You don't want a Revolutionary Party or a Northwest Republic. What you want is Batman. Now, this is understandable. Of course you want Batman. You are white Americans of the 21st century. You grew up getting your reality from various electronic screens, and you have been raised all your lives to expect Batman to leap out of somewhere and save the day. A life for you is entertainment and all the various hard and disgusting and exhausting things you have to do every day in order to keep being entertained. You go through your lives desperately seeking some way to escape from this backed-up toilet that we live in, thanks to the Jews and the various turd-colored minorities. And most of you escape into fantasy of various kinds every night, especially on the internet, Dungeons and Dragons and World of Warcraft and whatever. But sometimes you escape into my Northwest novels. Now, inevitably, my novels provide that kind of escape fantasy. I once had a man write in a review of my work that he loved my books because for a few hours at a time he could escape into a world where the good guys actually win sometimes. And I thank him for that. That's a perfectly legitimate reaction, and I'm glad that I can provide that kind of escape for you guys. God knows it's better than looking at internet porn. But all of this presumes that you people do have the sense enough to understand the difference between what is real and what isn't. Now, I fully accept that many of you are disappointed in me, and you are starting to wander away because my entertainment value is slipping, and you're getting bored with hearing the same old message every week. My message being that what you desire is attainable, and yes, you can have the world of the NVA and the Northwest Republic if you want it bad enough, but that you yourselves have to actually do something in order to attain it. No one is going to hand it to you on a platter simply to keep you placated and amused and keep you from goat dancing on the internet when you get bored and crotchety like a 6-year-old. Now, this is America. White Americans don't do. They demand. And then they scream and they jump up and down and hold their breath until their faces turn blue. And when they do that long enough, most times they do end up having things handed to them on a plastic tray and wrapped in cardboard and styrofoam like a Happy Meal. Now, that is the way that we've been taught to live, and I get that it is actually pretty much unreasonable of me to expect anything different, although I keep trying to reach that one man or woman in 1,000 among you who is different. The one man or woman in 1,000 among you who has enough self-awareness and introspection to see what is wrong in themselves and the willpower to at least try to change it. Apparently, though, I've underestimated some of you guys' inability to distinguish between what's real and what's not real, which, again, isn't unexpected since so many of us today deliberately choose to live in a world that is unreal, the world of the internet. Apparently, some of you seriously think that in writing these books, what I'm promising you is that I, myself, personally now, will appear one day on CNN and Fox News with my camouflage t-shirt ripped and blazing away with an M60 machine gun with long ammo belts draped over my shoulder like Rambo. And when I don't do this, you feel betrayed. You call me a fraud and you wander away in search of other entertainment. No. Okay, let me run this down for you yet again, just what I'm doing here and what I'm hoping to achieve. Now let's kick this off with a little saying of mine that all of you people really do need to wrap your minds around, because it is the starting point for understanding me and understanding my work. My novels are not written to tell you what to do. They are written to show you who you should be. The most important thing about the Northwest novels is not the plot lines or the shootings and explosions or the meticulously detailed guerrilla tactics. The most important thing in those pages are the characters, showing you what real white men and women of the old school should be like. Because for 60 years now, no one else has been willing or able to show you these things. You have forgotten what real white men and women are supposed to be like because there was never anybody around to tell you these things. I'm just reminding you. You can't change the world and build a new one without having some kind of plan. My Northwest novels talk about that plan in a depth that would not be possible outside of the fictional format. You can't put together a jigsaw puzzle without having that nice big picture on the cover of the box that shows you what the finished product looks like. That's what my Northwest novels are like. I'm giving you guys a glimpse of the cover of the box. I'm giving you a glimpse of the prize itself, and we need to learn to keep our eyes on the prize. My Northwest books are about the one thing that is holding us back from reclaiming the world we once ruled. They are about character. Our character, how completely sucky it is now, and how we can change that if we as a people can exercise the necessary effort of will. My novels are not written to promise you anything or predict anything. When the Northwest Republic comes into being, as it most certainly will one day in one form or another, it probably won't happen in the way that I predict in my books. Nor are my novels how-to manuals, as some have claimed. It's true that there's a lot of how-to type material in there, but that's just by way of making the books accurate and convincing more than anything else. I do not hope and do not intend to incite or provoke these same actions in real life. For one thing, it's not going to happen. If white men were ever going to revolt in arms against this unspeakable dictatorship, they would have done so long before this. Nothing is going to happen until there is a complete total transformation of the white man's thinking and the white man's character. That's what these Northwest novels are in aid of. Now, there are those of you out there who have made it clear to me that you consider yourselves disappointed and cheated because I have not produced the world of the Brigade for you on demand for your delectation on the 6 o'clock news every night. I'm sorry, you're going to have to remain disappointed. There are those of you who have made it clear that you think I'm some kind of fraud because I have not pulled out my magic wand or taken my magic beans out of my pocket and just made it all happen in a puff of smoke. Sorry, guys. No magic wand, no magic beans. Or rather, yes, there are some magic beans. It's you. You are my magic beans, and it is I who am very disappointed and disillusioned in you. I took you from my pocket and I threw you onto the ground years ago, so why haven't you sprouted? I have done all I can to get through to you guys, and God help me, I will continue to do so until I finally keel over or until they kick my door and take me away. But you need to stop looking at me for your solutions and start looking in the mirror, because that's where the solution has always been. This is Steve Earle.
Out found my papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now
Some of you would live through me, then lock me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. Did I feel alright? I feel alright tonight. I feel alright. Precious contraband and ancient tales from distant lands. Conquerors and concubines and conjurers from darker times. A betrayal and conspiracy, sacrilege and heresy. And I feel alright. I feel alright tonight.
I was going to conclude this episode of Radio Free Northwest with the usual impassioned plea to you guys to quit screwing around and get your asses up here. But I can do that anytime, and I'll be doing it often enough in the future. So instead, I think I'll wind up this week by reading a slightly updated version of the opening paragraphs of one of my more famous essays from back in the day, Dreaming the Iron Dream. And by the way, thank you all for the many birthday cards and letters and emails that you've sent me. I appreciate the sentiment. As I await the ticking over of the clock to the fatal day on Saturday, I find myself thinking of a day in early summer 42 years ago. On that day, having completed my final exam and thus my last day at Chapel Hill High School, I walked up to my car in the parking lot on a hill beside the school. I stopped at the summit of that hill, and I turned, looking back at the buildings, remembering all that had occurred there over the past 3 years. In that moment, I made a silent vow to myself that I would devote my life to ensuring that someday no white boy or girl would ever again have to go through what I had to go through in that place. To my frequent amazement, this vow of mine I've kept through over 4 decades of chaos and madness. The century that I was born into is gone now, and I think it's appropriate, as I'm about to turn 60, to sit and reassess where we've all been and what we've done. Now, many years ago, an author named Norman Spinrad wrote a book called The Iron Dream. Now, the book was not a very memorable one. It was a kind of a literary joke purporting to be what Adolf Hitler would have written had he immigrated to the United States after the beer hall putsch and become a science fiction writer in New York. Yet the phrase has stuck in my mind. I think it's a very good one, very descriptive of the kind of vision that National Socialism and all of us in white nationalism have for Aryan mankind. Our vision itself might be said to be an iron dream, a vision of a world and a human identity that endures like hard metal instead of decaying like mere flabby flesh, where the soul of man is hard and strong instead of weak and vacillating, The Iron Dream is the hidden instinctive soul of our mighty race. It lurks beneath the surface of the mind and desire of every white man and woman ever born, for it is the gift of the god or gods who forged our people from the ice and snow and granite of the vast forested expanse of our ancient homeland. All my life, I've dreamed the Iron Dream. I don't know why. Some are simply born out of step with their time, I suppose. Even as a child, I understood that things around me weren't right somehow, that this was not the way life is supposed to be. Always, I've been haunted, obsessed by a vision of a world very different from the one in which I grew up. An all-white world with very different standards and priorities. A world of strength and valor and glory, full of the qualities and virtues and experiences which have been so deliberately bred out of us by Judaic materialism. Now, when I was young, I had an idealized view of the past. All white faces, of course. But I had no idea of what this brave new world should be like in the future, until I discovered and understood the true meaning of Adolf Hitler, the Third Reich, and National Socialism. I have served the Iron Dream since that time, because for me there was no other conceivable path. Every opportunity which presented itself for me to conform, and there were many, I rejected out of hand. It wouldn't have been so hard. Like the ancient Roman Emperor Domitian, all the power structure asked was that occasionally I burn a small pinch of incense on the altars of the false gods of Judaism and materialism and diversity. But never once in my life have I burned that small pinch of incense which would have been my ticket to the wonderful world of money and consumer goods, that symbolic gesture of submission which would have meant, among other things, that I would have medical insurance when I reached age 60. At the age of 17, I recognized a racial, moral imperative which demanded my full attention and dedication, and I have submitted to it without question ever since. Not the usual 20th or 21st century life story, to be sure, or at least not very common since 1945. Making my peace with the system, a phrase that I have actually heard used in the past few years by some people who were once active in the resistance, is something which has simply never occurred to me. I talk about holy Aryan poverty, and possibly some of you think I'm making a virtue of necessity. I'm not. If I had it all to do over again, I'd change some things, sure. But I would essentially take the same path I've taken. I have never looked back. Well, time is up now, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.